This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The IU Northwest Center for Urban and Regional Excellence is offering up some non-credit online sessions, the way they put it, for learners of all ages. Almost sounds like a circus carnival, doesn't it? Well, maybe to some people it is. I don't know. But we have with us somebody who knows all about it. We have Ellen Zarletta. She's in charge of the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence to tell us about the classes. And Ellen, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Well, give us an idea of the thoughts behind creating the series of courses. A lot of these courses, I know, typically get held on campus during the summer, but that's not the case this year.
It's not the case, and we've made some adjustments, but we are still committed to offering our non-credit courses for learners, as we say, of all ages.
Mm-hmm.
We have adult education courses for those who want to explore some career skills or even other life skills. And then we also have courses that are specifically for seniors who are age 55 and older. And so I'll just take a minute and give you a few examples.
Yeah.
And so that people can get an idea of the types of courses that we do have.
Okay. Well, let's start out with the adult education courses first.
Sure. Okay. The adult education courses are, and as you mentioned earlier, we are having transition because of the circumstances that everybody is facing. We don't have face-to-face, and so they are all online.
Mm-hmm.
And so the adult education courses would include things like career exploration courses. So if someone wanted to be or thinking about becoming a pharmacy technician, we have an excellent class to open to anyone who's age 18 and over. And we have a state-licensed pharmacy tech who can explain just what it's like to be a pharmacy tech and answer questions about the profession so that people could explore this before they would move in the direction of becoming a pharmacy tech. Obviously,
yeah,
a very important job. We also have other adult education courses that are career training program courses, and we have a full set of online courses, everything from professional certifications to just life exploration, arts, et cetera. Over 1,000 courses that are offered online on a regular basis.
Wow. Yeah. Now, I know that what is included within the adult education sphere is something that's called Senior University. Tell us the thoughts behind that and what is offered during this special summer event this year.
Okay. Well, Senior University has been offered by IU Northwest for over 20 years. And so Garrett Cope, I want to make sure that we give him credit.
Mm-hmm.
He was the person who started the program, and it started out as an arts-oriented program. And over the course of a couple decades, we have evolved as the community's needs have changed. And so this summer, we have a special session on Social Security and COVID-19. So Social Security Administration, their specialists are going to be hosting a live online session so that people get some facts about what Social Security Administration is doing in response to COVID. Obviously, a very important topic as people who are retired, disabled, on Medicare are facing new challenges, and they might want some updates on what Social Security is doing. The second one, everybody is moving into growing their own food,
yeah,
and people are exploring community gardening. So we have one to talk about. We have a program that talks about eating to improve your immunity system. And we have a nutrition educator who's going to be delivering that program. And we have smartphones. We have so many different offerings.
Yeah. I know some of these offerings are very interesting, and a lot of them I know obviously are keyed to the fact that, number one, they're online courses, and number two, they're courses,
yeah,
that probably people would follow through on, I suppose, or maybe they wouldn't necessarily, like the introduction to social media. But I know there are a lot of seniors out there that are very much interested in what is happening these days. They may or may not be hooked up on Twitter. They may not be hooked up on Facebook, but they need to learn about them, and this is why, I guess, one way to,
yes,
kind of be instructed about them too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And in that case, we're trying to accommodate everybody's needs. We know that not everybody has access to computers or an iPad, and so that particular session is or can do their sessions live, because sometimes people are working. So this is going to be a recorded session, and we have a social media strategist who's been working for decades. She's a phenomenal teacher, and so she'll talk about those different platforms so people can make some decisions as to how it is they want to start interacting if they want to on social media. So Facebook, as you said, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn for people who are professionals and want to learn a little bit more about LinkedIn. All of those are recorded. You take them. They're self-paced. You can go and do it at your own leisure. And some of the other courses are live and online so that people can join by phone or by computer, mm-hmm. and they can ask questions of the instructors live as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, going down the list of some of the topics that are offered during these summer free online classes is one in particular, and you have nursing professor Crystal Shannon involved in this, and it's a very important one for seniors. The title of the program is called Remaining Safe in Times of Disaster. Tell us what Professor Shannon is going to talk about on this one.
Okay, so Professor Shannon is actually an expert in this work. She teaches for us in the area of emergency preparedness in our School of Nursing. She has she uses a number of different ways to communicate stories about what people have been through and then the lessons that those people have learned. And then she also provides everyone with some tips and hints mm-hmm. for how it is that they can prepare themselves in case of personal emergencies. There are ways for people to do self-assessments. There are some emergency plans she's going to be talking about. And so she's really good about tailoring it to the interests of the participants. And so because you'll be able to talk to her, it's a live session, people can ask questions and learn more about how to prepare given their particular circumstances.
I know
we want to remain safe.
I know there's one other course in particular, too, that kind of goes along with the seniors, senior at university concept. Is one, and people may know about Deepak Chopra's 21 Days of Abundance. And there is, I guess, a course that is offered in this summer offering this year that is tied in with Chopra's work.
Right. And that's called Live Your Best Life. It's important for us to reflect on, for all of us to reflect on how we're living our best life, which can be very stressful during times like this. So to take an opportunity to just sort of reflect and learn how to breathe, to find some inspirational readings, to get some introduction to meditation. She'll also be talking about stretching and relaxing and the importance of that and maintaining your health. And so you just find a quiet spot, get your pillow, grab your journal if you have one. And again, this is a live series, so you'll be in with a group of people, and they'll all be focused on trying to find the best mix of mind, body, and spirit activities for you so you can just take a moment and relax.
And Ellen, I know for sure there's one program where it is not necessarily geared to adults. The ones we've talked about so far within Senior University or some of these other related courses have adults in mind. But the summer reading programs are very interesting, and youngsters are involved in that too.
Yes. In fact, our summer reading skills program is for both children and adults. This has been a very successful program for us. We have run it for at least 10 years now. And this has also moved into a online environment. It used to be held at in various locations across Northwest Indiana. Now it's live and online, and the students can speak with the teachers. They complete some, they engage in discussion. There's some class activities, and by the end of that time period, people can have a better appreciation of what they can do to improve their reading skills. And, students are out in the summer, and so this is a great way for them to stay connected to learning and a very fun way for them to do it as well. So if you have children, we would encourage you to explore this reading skills program that's out there.
We've spent time here giving mostly highlights about these offerings from the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence and the very special 9 credit online courses. If anybody's interested, number one, in finding out more about the classes, and number two, about being able to register for them, what do they do?
Okay, well, you can connect with us in a couple different ways. We have our website, so if you go to www.iun.edu, you can search for us at that website under Cure, C-U-R-E, or the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence, and then our website. That's probably the easiest way. Our website will pop up. You can also contact us via email or phone. Phone number is 219-980-6978, 980-6978, and leave us a message. Our email is also on the website, and so you can just send us an email, and we make sure to get back to you within 24 hours.
That's great. Ellen Sarletta is the director of the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence at Indiana University Northwest, and we've been hearing more about some non-credit online sessions for learners of all ages that are being offered this summer. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
We grew up in the neighborhood that was near Pulaski School. And at the time that I went, it was an East Pulaski and a West Pulaski. One was for the black children, and the other one was for white children. We had a black principal, and then they had a white principal. And it wasn't until the neighborhood became completely integrated that they integrated those two schools. I grew up on a block called, it was on 16th and Rhode Island Street. It was black families and white families. On the corner from me, we had a little grocery store. We called her Missy. She was a white lady. I don't think we even knew how to pronounce her name. She had a Polish last name. We didn't know how to pronounce it, so we just called her Missy. On 16th and Vermont, we had a grocery store, and it was run by, her name was Mildred. And then on the other, one block east, we had another grocery store in the corner, and it was run by Louis Katz. And so we had these three stores right together, but they were run by white folks, and we went to those stores. I went to Pulaski School, as I said. In the seventh grade, the school board changed the rules, and they said that you had to go to the school that was in the district that was zoned for. Well, my sister, my brother, and most of the older kids in my neighborhood went to Roosevelt School, which, as you know, was an all-black school. There was a lot of history, there was all the camaraderie, and I was looking forward to going there. But by the time I got in the seventh grade, the school board had changed the rules. So we had to go to Emerson School. Emerson was majority white. As a matter of fact, when I graduated from high school, we had 135 graduates, and I believe it was 9 or maybe 11 who were black. We had a young lady who was very athletic, and she went out to become a cheerleader, and they booed her off the stage. Every year we had what we called a Christmas pageant. The participants were white. I don't remember if I was in maybe the 11th or 12th grade. They allowed one of the wise men to be black. But all the angels were white girls with blonde hair, okay? You know, we just were not, we were not welcome in terms of participating in that Christmas pageant. There were sometimes when there were some heated exchanges, there was some name calling, the N-word, that kind of thing. You know, we didn't necessarily like it, but we just kind of adjusted. I belonged to GAA, and they don't even do that anymore. It was called the Girls Athletic Association. And at the time, Emerson School owned a popcorn machine in the Memorial Auditorium. Whomever was sponsoring the event would ask the girls from the GAA to come and you know, do the popcorn. But if it was a basketball game between Gary Roosevelt and Gary Frable, where most of the participants were black, most players were black, most of the students attending were black, then they did not want to pop on that night. But those of us who were black, we were happy to do it on that night because there were a lot of black folks there. So you just kind of, I mean, you knew it. I'm not sure if acceptance is a good word for it, but you just kind of grew on you, I guess. And you know, sometimes even the teachers would create issues that did not need to be. I had a biology teacher I'll never forget who one day made a comment. If anybody came to her and caught a raccoon, she would send them down into the Central District in our area to sell it to us. because we ate that. We never ate it at my house, you know. So things like that, they happened. As I said, you kind of adjust it, but we didn't like it. We kind of adjusted.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. IU Northwest Economics Professor Micah Pollack has been very busy on his Twitter feed these days. He's been posting almost daily statistics about the coronavirus pandemic and its impact here on Northwest Indiana. And I've had a chance to check out some of the latest posts. You have to do that, too, on his Twitter page. But we have Professor Micah Pollack with us to talk about it. And thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, first, let me find out, besides the obvious question of the coronavirus kind of being an incentive, what got you started in doing these daily posts on Twitter?
It's kind of twofold. And one part is that, you know, sitting at home, like I'm sure many of us were at the beginning of the pandemic and still today, you know, you look for things to do to keep yourself entertained. And, you know, I love looking at data. And so just seeing this data set being created in real time and being updated daily that everyone was interested in, you know, I just kind of went naturally towards it. And the other part of it is, you know, I have two little kids and someone in the household that is immunocompromised. And so I have a very personal interest in tracking how the pandemic evolves and, you know, see how things are going.
Now, obviously, being the statistics wonk that you are, because it's part of your job and part of your nature, how did you start coming into creating all these graphs that basically every time you take a look at the post every day, that it contains a graph? And the information, how did you gather all that to be able to put the graphs together?
Well, when I started, there really wasn't any easy way to gather it. For the first few weeks of the pandemic, I was, you know, going onto the website and manually typing in from the ISDH's, you know, coronavirus dashboard, each of the county data points. Since then, it's gotten better. Now they provide all sorts of Excel files you can download that are updated daily, and it's much easier. But, you know, at the beginning, I was really just, you know, going one county at a time, recording everything until they had a more streamlined process.
Now, besides the State Department of Health information that you got to work with, did you have any other, or do you have any other data sources that you use when you put together your daily posts?
It kind of varies a little bit depending on what we're looking at. Obviously, there's also local city numbers and zip code numbers as well. So, you know, it kind of depends on what you're looking at. I also have done a couple pieces on Indiana Department of Corrections facilities and nursing homes. And so for those, we have data that's not updated quite as frequently, but there are some other sources there as well.
When you got the information together and you started posting all this information, what things were you looking at in particular that you wanted to be sure that viewers on your Twitter page got to see and got to maybe better understand than if they had gone on the State Department of Health website itself and tried to figure it out themselves? What in particular do you like to focus in on the not only each day, but for overall, what's your overall, global view of how things have turned out with the pandemic?
Sure. So when we started this data collection, you know, and I mean, we as in everyone in the world almost, you know, data was coming day by day, and there was a lot of emphasis on what does today look like versus yesterday. But now that it's been going on for a while, we have kind of a data series, a time series that's a little bit longer. And so what I like to focus on now is mostly seven-day moving averages of things, because there are very large day-of-week effects. And you know why that is, I'm not entirely sure, but, for example, here in Northwest Indiana, on a typical Saturday and Sunday, you have about 18 to 15 fewer cases reported than the rest of the week on average. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe some of that's, you know, testing centers are closed or people don't want to go and get tested on the weekend. And so by having a longer data set, you can look at kind of longer-term trends. You know, the data is very jumpy. So one day you might have a large number of new positives reported, but that might just be because there weren't that many reported over the previous few days. So it is important to kind of keep up to what's going on day to day, but also look at it from kind of a longer term perspective as well.
Now, since you have all these followers that you've been able to pick up because of all this work that you've done since the pandemic really hit, and we've basically you've created this database on Twitter, what kind of followers comments do you get on the average, and what things do you try to, at least if they have questions, try to answer for them?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting being active on Twitter. because at the beginning, there, you know, the ISDH would put out data, but there wasn't a whole lot of discussion, analysis, and graphs. And so I started getting involved with that. And then I've run into some colleagues on Twitter, Gabriel Bosslet and Roger Johnson, are two medical doctors downstate that do something very similar for their region. And so we kind of have a little working group. We get together and we talk about, you know, the latest trends, and we bump ideas off each other before, you know, we post them. And so it's really created this kind of online collaborative environment. And, you know, if somebody has a question about, you know, Southwest Indiana, I send them over to Roger Johnson, and he does the same for Northwest Indiana. And then whenever there's a big change statewide, we kind of hash it out and say, you know, is this a significant change in the trend, or is it just a one day, you know, bit of noise? And mm-hmm. So it's been really interesting getting involved on there. In terms of the people that follow me, I feel like I get very positive comments. I like to think that one of the things I'm good at is taking data and converting it into graphs that are relatively easy to understand and kind of convey the meaning effectively. And so that's what I try to do, is how do I display this information and explain it in a way that's the most understandable, approachable, and intuitive.
Okay. Well, give us some examples of what you talk about in particular, and trying to kind of parse through the data and try to explain it to people so they can understand it. What are some examples you can offer us, either, you know, in general or some of the more recent comments?
Sure. So probably the two variables I look at most closely are just simply the 7-day moving average of new cases. So basically, over the last week, on average, how many new cases were reported in, say, Northwest Indiana? And that gives you kind of a reasonable trend that's, you know, not affected by day of the week so much. And for example, in June, here in Northwest Indiana, we've dropped from about 80 cases per day on average till during the first 2 weeks, we dropped down to about 34. Mm-hmm. And now we've climbed back up to about 54 cases per day. So by looking at the 7-day moving average, it gives you an idea of the trend with some of the noise that happens day to day, kind of averaged out from there.
And you're figuring, obviously, that we're seeing this jump, and in this case, back up. It's because we have more things opened or reopened, I should say, and in turn, more people are getting out and doing things that they hadn't obviously been able to do in the stay-at-home orders.
Yeah, so why the cases are going up is difficult to say. It could be that. You know, we are seeing more cases rising elsewhere too, so, you know, we could have more cases coming into the community. One thing that is a little concerning though is, you know, we see more cases now, and talking about the trends, it's challenging because there's a lot of nuances. So we're seeing more cases now, but we're also doing more testing. So we're in Northwest Indiana doing about 1,000 tests a day, which is up about 40% from the beginning of June. So how do you know if we're just not finding more cases because we're doing more testing? And for that, that's the second variable that I look at. In addition to the 7-day moving average of positive cases, I look at the percentage of tests that are positive. And this is now kind of a metric that everyone has settled on as a measure of how many cases we're missing out there. So, you know, when you test somebody, if you're testing just the people that are the most obvious, obviously sick, those that are in, you know, the ICU rooms and things like that, you're going to have a very high percentage of those tests positive. You know, maybe 50, 60, 70% are going to be top positive. If you're doing sufficient testing, if you have a lot of tests out there, then that percentage should drop quite a bit. And, mm-hmm. and generally, anything less than 10% of tests positive mm-hmm. is a good sign for enough testing. And so since June, you know, we've fallen from 10% at the beginning of June down to about 4.5%, which is great news here in Northwest Indiana, but it's starting to creep up a little bit. So even though, you know, we're testing way more, you know, today than we were a week ago even, we're not seeing that much lower percentage of tests positive, which is kind of a bad sign. It shows that there are maybe a lot more cases out there than there were before that we're just simply not detecting.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Indiana University Northwest economics professor Micah Pollack. He is on Twitter with almost daily posts and statistics concerning the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact here in Northwest Indiana. By the way, if you want to check it out, it's at Micah Pollack. That's M-I-C-A-H. Pollack, P-O-L-L-A-K, and it's on Twitter. Now, obviously, since you're very concerned about economic matters, that's one of the things that you normally check on, is how we've been able to cope with issues here in Northwest Indiana in particular. What's your assessment right now that we have more businesses open and, I guess, slowly getting some of the industries open as well, once the situation allows it with the pandemic still on? What are you seeing here in Northwest Indiana that may be an indicator that will creep ever closer back to normal, if you can call it that, or the new normal, I guess, is what I keep hearing.
Yeah, so there are some signs that things are improving a little bit. Just the other day, Indiana announced that the unemployment rate fell to 12.3%, and kind of have mixed feelings about that because 12.3% is a huge number compared to where we were early in this year. But at the same time, it is falling, which is good news. I think, though, we're in a little bit of a holding pattern with all of the cases that are, growing in other states and maybe with a little uptake here in Indiana. Businesses are a little concerned about fully committing to reopening, and whether the unemployment continues to tick down and things start to recover, I think will depend a lot on what happens in the next 2 weeks or so, both here in Indiana and nationwide as well.
Is there anything in particular that you would hope that people that make a regular issue of checking things out, and we're not only talking about your Twitter feed, but the other sources that are out there, the state sources, any other local sources that are out there, is there anything that you're hoping that people will be able to take away and I guess maybe change their own lives by whatever they have to do, besides the usual things about social distancing, wearing masks, making sure that you keep your bubble, as they want to call it now, as small or as intimate as you can?
Yeah, so I think that as things open up and as people kind of go back to their day-to-day lives, there's definitely a feeling that maybe this wasn't as bad as we thought, or we shouldn't be as concerned about it. But I would caution everyone to be careful with that. It's true that the mortality rate is relatively low. It still is probably about twice the mortality rate of the flu, but it's so much more widespread. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to, set aside your mask and maybe not wear it if you're going out. But, as hard as it is to keep doing this month after month or week after week at least, we need to keep up with this. There's been all sorts of overwhelming evidence showing that, masks greatly reduce the spread. It doesn't hurt that much to wear a mask, right? I mean, it's a small thing you can do that ultimately just, demonstrates that you're caring about your neighbors and your fellow citizens. And if we all wore masks, it would be over a lot sooner than I think it will be otherwise.
Now, I don't want to get politics involved in this, because I know in your case you're an economist and you don't delve that deeply in this, but we know that all the word comes out that it seems that folks who lean one way to in the political spectrum than the other, they tend to be more concerned. They tend to, say, wear masks more often. They tend to take more precautions and the like. Does Northwest Indiana seem to fit in, from what you know and what you've seen through the data and you see almost on a regular basis? Does that seem to be happening here? Are we in Northwest Indiana kind of following the rules, so to speak, and doing a better job of it than perhaps any other part of the Hoosier State?
I think Indiana as a whole did quite well at the beginning of the shutdown and even during the beginning of the reopening. We're one of the few states that reopened early and hasn't seen a subsequent spike yet. But I think that a lot of people have gotten complacent, have maybe said, I don't really need to wear the mask anymore. I think this is mostly over. And that's kind of dangerous. If we want to avoid further spikes, it's absolutely important to continue wearing a mask. And, it shouldn't be a political thing, right? Wearing a mask is a minor inconvenience, but if you can avoid getting sick yourself or getting other people sick, I mean, it's a very small price to pay to be, a little uncomfortable when you go into the grocery store for a half an hour. I think it's well worth it, regardless of how you feel politically.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, since going through all the data and updating the data as often as you do for your Twitter feed, what new things, if there are any new things, that you would like to try to get hold of and incorporate in what you put out there on Twitter?
So I think, it's always going to be the case that I would love more data. Mm-hmm. Some of the places where we had large outbreaks initially, for example, nursing homes, prisons, meatpacking plants, there's not really good data out there. So, I've done what I can with what the Indiana Department of Corrections releases, but it would be nice to have kind of more detailed data from them. Even, long-term care facilities, the state publishes every week. Some numbers, but they don't publish some things like the number of tests that are administered. They just publish the number of cases and the number of deaths. And so, a little bit more detailed data, a little bit more frequent data, would be really helpful, especially as, the nature changes and we have people that are now getting antibody tests instead of just your traditional kind of swab test. And so, how those get incorporated and what they represent, we kind of just need more explanation and kind of transparency there.
Now, let me finally ask you here, Micah, are you getting some kudos for what you do, all this work that you put together, all this information and data that you put out there on Twitter? Are you getting some compliments, getting some complaints about it?
I actually have gotten very few complaints because, I try to simply present the data in a way that captures what the data is showing. So I'm not trying to tilt it towards showing that, you know, there are cases that are going down or up. And, you know, those that follow me sometimes, you know, they don't like that. I maybe one week I'm taking a very negative view because that's what the data is showing. And then the next week, you know, maybe it's a little bit more rosy view. So I definitely have lost a few people that maybe don't like hearing the way things are going. And, you know, I try to keep it as close to the data as possible.
Well, once again, give us your Twitter handle and how people can check this out for themselves and become addicted to looking at your Twitter feed and find out all this great information about the coronavirus pandemic here in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. So you can follow me on Twitter. It's at Micah Pollack, which is MICAHPOLLAK. And as you mentioned, Chris, I try to daily publish the newest data that comes out.
Yeah.
Obviously, sometimes it doesn't come out every day. I am unable to do it every day. But I also try to do kind of occasional pieces that focus on different topics like demographics and, you know, how the positive rate and the death rate is inordinately affecting minorities and, you know, things like the prison system and long-term care facilities. So it's kind of a mix of that, plus on top of a regular daily Northwest Indiana update.
Micah, thank you very much for talking about all of this, and keep up the good work, I guess we could say. That'd be a trite phrase, but certainly pertains to this, and we'll be back to check with you, and hopefully we'll have some updates to tell people about as well, and they can find out the more current updates by going to your Twitter feed.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris, for having me.
Micah Pollack is an economics professor at Indiana University Northwest, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today on the program. Tomorrow, we will bring you a conversation with the Indiana University Northwest history professor emeritus, James Lane. He and co-author Ronald Cohen have given us another edition, in fact, the third edition here, of a book which is entitled A Pictorial History of Gary. We'll have that conversation for you. And we have Green Fleet Radio with Carl Lissig from South Shore Clean Cities with us as well. All part of tomorrow's program here on Regionally Speaking. We hope you can join us.